Africa is living a very special moment. Many even call it the African moment, because we have moved from Afro-pessimism all the way to Afro-enthusiasm, not just Afro-optimism. And the reason is because the drivers behind the transformation taking place in Africa are proving to be more resilient than anybody could have expected. In light of the financial crisis, Africa was supposed, as in the past, to suffer more than any other region. And this not only did not happen, but the countries in the continent are posting some of the fastest growth rates in the world. 6 out of 10 fastest growing countries in the world are African. But I think it's more important for us not to just look into the economic good indicators that we have right now, but beyond these economic indicators, some of the megatrends that are behind this transformation. And the megatrends point in the direction of a growing middle class, much more urbanized youth that is capable of mastering new technologies. Africa has some of the indicators on IT comparable to India, despite, you know, the image and the cliches that we may have about the continent. We have also indications that the governance is progressing through different indexes, such as the Mo Ibrahim Index on Governance in Africa. So there is really a sense of very strong assertiveness and pride on the continent. So ECA has to change to capture this moment and to be much more meaningful as an organization in this process of transformation. So what we have agreed is that we needed to have a strategy combined with the African Development Bank and, of course, our political leader, which is the African Union, and together the three Pan-African institutions being able to complement each other in the most synergetic possible way. For instance, the fact that the ECA is considered as a think tank of the continent is very nice for us to hear. But as a think tank, it's not having the impact that it should have. So we need to become much more specialized. Our products, knowledge products basically, need to be much more known. And we need to be bolder in terms of policy proposals that are really going to make an impact in different areas that are crucial for the Africa's transformation, such as, you know, what we do with land, what we do with industry, what we do with natural resources exploitation, what we do with the fact that, you know, we have a youth bulge and we have a demographic curve that is going to put Africa in a completely different league in a number of years, and so on and so forth. So this is the drive that is behind some of the transformations I think ECA has to lead, and I, as an individual in charge of it, I'm going to do my best to make sure that the African agenda is going to be an African agenda decided by the Africans, because we cannot afford anymore that even when the good news are out there, they are not good news that are mastered by the Africans.
You mentioned the Mo Ibrahim Foundation and the work that it is doing on the continent to improve democracy. And you also know that there is a lot of instability in other countries on the continent. How does that gel with your vision of trying to make sure that these things become, you know, an issue of the past? We have leaders in Africa who respect the rule of law. So there is that development that everyone is yearning for.
Well, first of all, we have to go to the root causes of the conflict. We have two bands in Africa that historically have provoked many conflicts over the centuries. The Sudano-Sahelian band, because it is a fight for scarce resources. And you see that it goes all the way from one coast to the other. And this is something that we have to insert in our analysis. We have to contextualize that some of these problems of conflict are not really going to be solved if the approach is going to be just national, because they are by nature of a transborder type of situation. And now with globalization, we have also the globalization of criminal activities, not to mention the fact that you have also some profiting from the instability, the insecurity that exists in these areas to put a varnish of, you know, it can be a religious nature or other types of ideologies of extremism. Then you have a second band that by nature is also provoking a fight for resources, but this time because it has overwhelming richness of resources, and that is the Rift Valley all the way to the Great Lakes region. In these two bands, you have had tremendous number of conflicts. It doesn't go away easily. The interests are huge, and I think we have to contextualize some of these conflicts. The second very important analysis we have to make is the fact that these conflicts are not really impeding growth rates in even the most affected countries. An economy like Sudan, until they got into this fight for resources with South Sudan, was growing at 8%. The countries in the Great Lakes region, including the ones most affected by conflict, are all growing at more than 5%, and so on and so forth. So this only compounds the need for us to be a bit more sophisticated in the analysis about governance and rule of law. Because if we don't become sophisticated, people are just going to throw at our face that, after all, we are growing and, you know, things are moving in the right direction economically. Well, the problem is that if you don't have good distribution, if you don't have quality of growth, you are not going to improve the lot of the majority. We have, for instance, problems of equity. We have problems of disparities growing rather than diminishing despite the good results that we are seeing in the economic front. And most of it is because the accountability frameworks that we have are not there. They are not sufficient. They are weak. With a few exceptions, most of the countries need to reinforce that. That's the only way people will be able to participate in transformation, and it will be for the good of the majority of the Africans. So rule of law is extremely important in that endeavor, and that's why, you know, we need to make an effort to put the political leadership of Africa on notice about the need to really make real structural transformation.
And looking at the environment in which you are working in right now, you are in Addis, and there are so many conferences, one conference after the other. When I look at your speeches, they are very bold. You are telling it like it is. But how do we move from those speeches to making sure that it is actually practical what happens on the ground?
By being not just bold and getting the story out there as it is, but by being also very technically sound, very rigorous on what we put at the table in terms of policy proposals, insofar as the Economic Commission for Africa is concerned. But more generally, more widely, we should really look into putting in the hands of people the information that will allow them to ask for accountability. I'm going to give you an example that I give a lot here in Addis. We don't control our statistical knowledge. It's mostly based on projections. Normally, statistics have two pillars, the demographic statistics and national accounts. If they are not up to date, which is the case with the majority of the African countries, every other statistic is based on some wild projection, some abstract projection. You can have a very good econometric model, or you can have just, you know, guesswork that, you know, is going to be bought by whoever is going to consume your statistics. And the end result of all of this is that, you know, you have governments waiting for someone else to tell them what is their GDP growth. This is unthinkable in other regions of the world. We are lagging behind on this big time. Now, the real reason this is important is not just because technically you need good numbers to have good planning and to have good strategies. It's because you need good numbers to be able to account for how taxes are used, for how people can compare, you know, expenditure on this particular area compared to the other. And you get more information about the informal sector. That is the only way you are really going to move into regional integration. Because any number that people give you about regional trade in Africa is completely fake, because most of the trade is being done informally, and so on and so forth. So you need really to be sound, technically sound, in order to shift the discourse from just proclamations, from ideological proclamations, into real accountable frameworks and real policy that is going to work for the benefit of the majority.
And you mentioned the majority, and right now in Africa, the youth are in the majority, and most of them are out of employment. How does that, you know, come into the development agenda to make sure that those youths do not get left behind, much more as we have been in the past by other continents?
Well, if you look into the leaders of Pan-Africanism, and it's very befitting to do that, because we are going to commemorate 50 years of the foundation of the OAU, and you look at the ages that they had when they were involved in these very big projects of transformation on the political side, you know, getting independence, affirming nationalism, proclaiming Pan-African solidarity, fighting colonialism. All of these leaders, they were in the 30s, some were in the 20s, and they took the destiny in their own hands. They were really exposed to a level of discrimination, stigma, marginalization that much worse than what we can find with our youth today. They didn't have computers, they didn't have cell phones, they could not tweet. All of these things that now the youth in Africa are mastering in a way that is unprecedented. We have the growth of the telephone companies becoming like the beacon and the reference for the potential of the middle class in Africa. It's over 300% right now, according to the International Telecommunications Union. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us that we need to create the space politically for the youth to really be participating. We should not patronize the youth. We should not talk on their behalf. We should look into an Africa in about 20 years that is going to be very different from age composition than it is now. And now it's already the youngest continent, so it's going to be much more. And we need to look into the implications of this for the world, because you will have, just in a country like Japan, by 2015, about 100,000 people that will be over 100 years old. How are they going to maintain their social security system? How they are going to provide the medical support that will be needed for this aging population? They will have to pair with the youngest continent, whether they like it or not. And this is going to be the trend. So we need to create the opportunities inside for political space for the young. We need to be cognizant of the fact that the world is going to change in their direction. And we need also, and this is why I was talking about Pan-African solidarity and the forefathers that we had, we need also to tell the youth that they should not ask permission for being active. They have to just take the destiny in their own hands, like those did who did in 50 years ago, were so proud of being, you know, the main drivers and the actors of transformation.
What is holding them back from, you know, going that step further to go into developmental issues?
They are not being passive or restive about it. On the contrary, if we see what has happened in Niger that provoked the transformation that brought the current president to power, what happened in North Africa, the various riots that, you know, obliged a defensive attitude on the part of many governments, be it in Senegal, Burkina Faso, Mozambique, Malawi, South Africa, Kenya. The youth has been very active and they are not letting their chance pass. But they are also very disappointed that when they make their movements and they try really to change society, there is a sort of utilization of their energy and the transformation to a status quo that is different from what they found at the beginning of their processes, but not something that really responds to their demands. And I think we have to be prepared for a backlash on the part of the youth if we are not going to give them the space they need and the space they deserve. And I think, you know, when I say they should not ask permission, it's precisely because, like 50 years ago, people were capable of just taking the destiny in their own hands. I really am convinced that the youth are going to do the same, whether we like it or not. So it's better to not patronize them and to involve them in the decision-making process.
And looking at the post-2015 development agenda, what do you envisage would be the best development framework for Africa's leaders continue to seek sustainable growth?
Well, you see, the post-2015 agenda will be highly influenced by the Millennium Development Goals, the MDG process, and that process had failures insofar as Africa is concerned. First, the level of effort to attain the targets of the MDGs was not really measured. If you say that you are going to reduce poverty in the world by half by the year 2015, and you just translate that target for every country, regardless of where is the baseline, it's a completely unfair process, because reducing poverty by half in Sweden is not the same as reducing poverty by half in Mali. The level of effort is completely different. And from an historical perspective, you know, the economic underpinnings that will allow for that to happen cannot really be measured in terms of the number of years that you have for the targets in developed countries. So this is something that we have to correct with the new agenda. Another thing that we need to correct is the enablers. You cannot really concede that you have a number of very noble objectives, including the ones that relate to the social indicators, and think that this is going to happen just by magic. It depends on a number of factors, including, of course, whether you have infrastructure, whether you have access to finance, whether you really have a financial crisis in the world, what demand is increasing or decreasing for commodities. So all these elements that were completely ignored in the way the agenda was defined until now, have now to come to the fore. And the third element that I think is equally important is that the SDGs allowed us to basically get out of the structural adjustment period, where there was a lot of conditionality, prescription of policies, and African countries suffered a great deal out of, you know, the blindness of some of these policies. With the MDGs, what we got was policy space. You are talking about goals, not about policy prescription, not about how you attain things, but rather what you want to attain. And you leave the space for each one to find its own way. This has to be preserved, because this was a gain that allowed countries to flourish. And this is why, you know, Africa is in a growth path. It's not the only reason, but it's a fundamental reason. The way we are dealing with macroeconomic policy, the way we are dealing with, you know, making choices in the countries, has completely reversed the situation that we used to have in the 80s and the 90s.
And another subject that is different from what we were talking about, but really connected as well, is one issue of the African diaspora. How does Africa tap into the African diaspora in terms of, you know, development? How can the diaspora assist in developing Africa?
You see, when you look into the rise of China and the rise of India, just to keep these two examples in mind, because in terms of population and demographics, they are the most similar to the African continent, you will be astonished with the role that the diaspora has played. From the very beginning, even the economic zones that were established in China, they were highly influenced by the spirit and the policies of Singapore, of a number of other diasporic nations of China. But then, you know, there was a huge effort to try to attract investment from the diaspora, including in the case of China, in no-go areas such as Taiwan, that contributed a great deal for transfers of funding and capital, and of course of the technology as well, to increase, you know, and boost Chinese economy. The same has happened with India. And now it's the turn of Africa also to value its diaspora, value the experience of its diaspora, its networking capabilities, its funding potential, to integrate this diaspora fully into our development. I think there are a number of countries that have already shown the way, because they have even included the diaspora into the political processes. A case in point would be the small island states in Africa. But I think we have to go much further than that. You know, you have situations where, like in the case of Egypt, the diaspora is already playing a very important role. In Ethiopia, it's incredible how much they are investing. So I think we need to really to include the diaspora much more in the structural discussions about Africa's development. And this has been accepted by the African Union, that has decided to make the diaspora the sixth region, and that has already started, you know, putting the diaspora up front in a number of programs. I will give you the example that is symbolic but very significant. All people that really are very interested in Africa and the journey of the Africans knows how much the general history of Africa done by UNESCO has played a role in demonstrating our identity is complex but is also a source of pride. But there was one volume that was missing in that general history of Africa. What was the diaspora contribution? And they have just decided that this year, because of the 50 years of Pan-African institutional history, they are going to publish one more volume that will cover this. I think symbolically is very important and significant, because we have to understand where we have come from to be able to understand where we are going.
And lastly, when we look at the issue of institutions in Africa, the need for institutions that can engender confidence in Africa to lure more investors, how can you as the ECA, working with your colleagues at the African Union and the African Development Bank, help African governments develop those strong institutions that will help to ensure that continuity in the region?
Well, one of the things we can do is actually to master much better the information about the continent, because I think you will not be able to achieve that type of quality, rigor, and legitimacy if the institutions in charge of producing this information in the African continent are not put at a level and a standard that is respected worldwide. So this is an effort that may seem very focused and rather limited. Why is he talking about numbers all the time? Because the numbers are so fundamental for you to control the narrative. If you don't control the numbers, you don't control the narrative. You recycle other people's numbers. You recycle also other people's analysis and narrative. Institutions in Africa in charge of this are like the foundation for other types of institution building. Because remember, in management, what you can measure, you can account. What you don't measure, you don't account. So if you don't have a good basis to introduce more sophisticated and effective management techniques, you are not going to improve the lot of the institutions in Africa. It's not a coincidence that the most sophisticated economies in the continent, such as South Africa, are also the ones that master this. It's not a coincidence at all. It's what we have to emulate. We have to do much more of it. And I think we are very much engaged as Economic Commission for Africa. And I think, you know, I can talk on behalf of African Development Bank and the African Union on this. Everybody is going to make a pitch, actually, through this joint effort that we are making for a Vision 2063 for the continent, to make sure that institution building is very much at the center of our reflection about ownership. Because when we say we need to have more ownership, what we mean is that we want to be in charge of our own destiny. You cannot be in charge of your own destiny if you don't even master the knowledge that is like the foundation for you to be able to plan and strategize.
But so far, would you say that all the other leaders, the African leaders as you have met them and others who are leading these organizations, which will be working with you as you bring that vision together, are you all together on the same platform?
No, it's a mixed bag. And you have people that are mobilized and there are people that still have some way to go. There are leaders that are disappointing in terms of their governance performance. We have a mixed bag. There's no doubt about it. But if you look into the macro dimension of what is happening in the continent, you have an energy, you have a drive that didn't exist before. I'll just give you an example that for me is very significant. Just a few years back, countries that were catalogued in the UN classification as least developed countries were fighting tooth and nail to keep that classification because they thought this was the best they could hope to keep aid flows intact. Today, you go and see the same countries, leaders, and what they tell you is that I have a vision to graduate out of the least developed category by year X. And I think this is really very encouraging. It shows that there is the beginning of a mindset change. It is going to take time? Yes. So it is our responsibility. All that are contributing to the formulation and the shaping of the African agenda to accelerate that momentum.